This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents The Female of the Species by Mindy McGinnis. Performed by Amanda Dolan, Justice Boulding, and Dan Bittner.
Chapter 1. Alex. This is how I kill someone. I learn his habits, I know his schedule. It is not difficult. His life consists of quick stops to the dollar store for the bare minimum of things required to keep this ragged cycle going. His hat pulled down over his eyes so as not to be recognized. But he is. It's a small town. I watch these little exchanges. They evolve in seconds from, I get paid to smile at you, to the facial muscles going lax when recognition hits, the price scanner making a feeble attempt to break the silence by making a beep-beep when his food goes past. I know this pattern, but watch it anyway. The bread, the cheese, the wine, and the crackers that he sometimes will crumble and put out for the birds, a tiny crack of kindness that makes him all the more hateful. Because if there's a version of him that feeds birds as winter descends, then there is a decency that he chose to overlook when he did other things. Other things that also fed the birds, and the hawks, and the raccoons, and the coyotes. All the animals that took mouthfuls of my sister, destroying any chance of proving he killed her. But I'm not a court, and I don't need proof. I know this road, the one that leads out of town. He'll take a right, where the bridge has been out for a decade, then follow the gravel that shoots to the left, each path becoming more decrepit than the last, from two lanes to one, from paved to gravel, and then just dirt. Dirt leading into the woods. I know all these things because I've seen them every day for months. I'm just a girl trying to get in shape this summer. Shedding the last baby fat as my womanhood emerges. How clean I look. How fresh and hopeful and one with the outdoors as I strain to make it up the hill, and then exuberant as I fly down the other side, hair streaming behind, enjoying my earned reward. This is what people think when they see me. The few people who live out here wave as I go past, awkwardly at first, but later in recognition. As the days get hotter, one elderly lady waits at the end of her driveway every day with a glass pitcher of lemonade. She knows exactly what time I will pass her house, and my drink is always cold, the ice cubes clinking against my teeth. I do this at first so that it won't be odd that I'm there on that day. I've come to like it. The way my legs have become all muscle, and how my hair smells like wind hours later. I like the lemonade, too. I almost look forward to seeing the old lady. But I never let it distract me. Because this is not how I get in shape and make new friends. This is how I kill someone. And it's a simple process, really. His hand hesitates for a second when he sees me pause at the end of his driveway. Yes, he's one of the people who wave. He sits on his porch most of the day, a middle-aged man who might be handsome if you don't look closely into his eyes and identify what lurks there. Every day, the sun rises and the wine bottle empties, and he sits there wondering where his life went wrong until it sets again. I know exactly where. I'll explain that to him. He's lonely. So, when I stop for the first time ever, I almost feel bad when his face lights up. Almost. Because immediately following that pure smile of a human being who craves the company of another human being, his eyes flick down to my tank top, where my breasts heave up and down as I catch my breath. and we're not two human beings anymore. We're a male and a female, alone in the woods. And I lie, say that I'm winded, need to sit down for a minute. And part of him knows he shouldn't do this. The part that crumbles up crackers and feeds them to birds knows that he shouldn't bring me out of the sun into the darkness of his house. But another part wants to, and it's much stronger. I go, smiling when he holds the screen door open for me. It makes my nose scrunch up and draws attention to my freckles, which everyone says make me so cute. They have no idea. I walk inside, into the cool shadows, pretending not to hear when he flicks the lock on the screen door. Then I turn around and tell him who I am. This is how I kill someone. And I don't feel bad about it.
Chapter 2. Jack. The thing about Alex Kraft is, you forget she's there. I didn't give her much thought until we were freshmen, chomping at the bit to help with search parties for her sister. We enjoyed pretending to be adults, the feeling that we were actually doing something, even though most of us forgot to check the batteries on our flashlights, and Park had a baggie in his pocket that stopped our searching cold once we were out of sight of the real adults. Brantley actually packed a snack, like we were going camping or something. To be fair, after the baggie was empty, we were totally thrilled, and she was our hero, just like she wanted. She sat on my lap that night, happy to squirm right where she knew I liked it. And I didn't stop her. I've never stopped Brantley. Still haven't learned how. So our hero was the girl who brought Doritos to chase our weed, and a few yards away from where we sat, an actual hero found the body. Parts of it, anyway. We didn't even notice the gathering flashlights until the girl Park was with made a noise when he got her in just the right place and they swung toward us. I've thought about it a lot in the 3 years since, how we must have looked in that glare. Brantley's Find Anna shirt shoved up over her tits, my pants around my ankles, all of us with red-rimmed eyes and big, oh shit, looks on our faces. The guy out in front was all rugged-looking, dirty beard and a hat, a loose jacket. The kind of guy who I thought would laugh and tell us to keep on going while he kept the light on us. But he never even glanced at Brantley or Park's girl while they yanked their clothes in place. Instead, he looked right at me and said, "Get the fuck out of here, douchebags." I was so busy tucking it all back in, I thought everybody was pissed because of us, that their faces were set hard and their lights were pointing at the ground because they didn't want to know, for sure, what we'd been doing. But that wasn't it. Her hand was sticking up out of the dirt, stripped to the bone, the gnawed-on skin peeled back to the wrist. I froze in the act of pulling up my zipper. I didn't know then that once the area was cordoned off, parts of Anna Kraft would be found all over the place. I thought it was a shallow grave she tried to dig herself out of, with me a few yards away doing my best to pound a different girl down into the ground. "What?" Brantley had said, eyes on my face as always, completely missing that they'd found what we were supposed to be looking for. I left her. I did exactly what that guy said and turned around and got the fuck out of there. I ran because one of the faces in that circle of light was Alex Kraft, a girl I'd gone to school with my whole life. A girl who sometimes you don't see. I saw her then, as she reached down to touch her sister's dirt-streaked fingers, like a kid digging up a toy that got mired in the sandbox, and I haven't been able to unsee her since. This is what I think about when she brushes past me on the first day of our senior year, her dark hair swinging as she walks, face still wearing the hard mask I saw that night, like it's permanently set. I wonder if she heard that guy call me a douchebag, and I want to know if she agrees, because I sure as hell do.
Chapter 3. PK. I have a name, but everyone just calls me PK because I'm the PK, preacher's kid. I'm thinking about this because my name, or at least my nickname, should be somewhere in the pic Sarah just sent me. A screen cap she snatched off my boyfriend's phone while he was passed out at a party. a screen cap of increasingly dirty sexting that should alternate between Adam and PK, but instead says Adam and Branley. I toss my phone into the passenger seat and focus on not crying while I wait for the woman from the animal shelter to arrive and unlock the building. My leg is bouncing up and down while I burn off my anger, the car keys jangling against my knee. I yank them out of the ignition when I spot the beaded keychain that says, PK and Adam forever. It's made out of letters and footballs and hearts, the paint rubbed away in spots from years of friction as it passed in and out of my jeans pocket. Years. Fucker, I say, and break the black cord that holds them all together, sending letters and hearts and footballs all over my car. I'm not supposed to say that word, because I'm a preacher's kid. But I'm also not supposed to drink beer or know what a dick smells like, so language is the least of my sins. My phone makes a noise at me, the one that used to make me dive for it in the middle of the night, breathless and happy. A noise that used to send my stomach up in my throat. Except now, that organ is definitely going another way, and I get out of my car so I don't have to look at the screen all lit up with his name, hearts on either side of it. Some beads roll out behind me, and one crunches under my foot as I get out. It's the end. More pieces fall out onto the gravel, and I hear another car. I tuck my hands up into the sleeves of my hoodie because it's colder than it's supposed to be today, thanks Ohio, and I'm ready to get inside the shelter and start my senior year experience. On my grade card it will say SYE, Animal Shelter Volunteer, and that will probably be followed by a capital A, nicely aligned with all the others. I have a very different idea about what constitutes a senior year experience, and Adam was supposed to be a part of that, until now. I stomp my foot, telling myself I'm doing it to keep warm and that the little heart charm that has now been ground into a fine powder had nothing to do with it. The other car pulls up next to mine, but it's not the lady from the shelter, it's another student, and it takes me a second to place her as she gets out of the car. Actually, that's kind of a lie. I know exactly who she is. I just can't remember her name. So I'm standing there, my fists balled up in fabric and my feet smacking against the ground, when I say, "Hey, Anna, you volunteering here for SYE?" She looks at me for a second before I realize what I just did. "I'm Alex," she says. "I know, right, yeah, I totally know," I say, my words falling out all over each other. It's just that when you look at me, all you think about is my older sister, so your brain offers that name instead. "Yeah," I say, more than a little set back by her factual presentation, like I'm a science fair judge instead of a girl who just put her foot in her mouth. "Yeah," she echoes back at me, then moves toward the shelter, which, it turns out, was unlocked. I watch her walk away from me, back rigid, and I think, it's going to be a long senior year experience. Then I hear my phone again, insistently making its Adam noise, and I think about those texts between him and Branley Jacobs, and that word slips out of me again. Fucker. It's cold enough that it makes a fog in front of my mouth when I say it, and even though I brushed good this morning, I can smell stale beer. So there's the word and the beer, all hanging there together in the air. And my dad would probably be really disappointed in me right now. Also because I know what a dick smells like. Or what Adams does, anyway. But just his.
Chapter 4. Alex. It's easier to like animals than people, and there's a reason for that. When animals make a stupid mistake, you laugh at them. A cat misjudges a leap. A dog looks overly quizzical about a simple object. These are funny things. But when a person doesn't understand something, if they miscalculate and hit the brakes too late, blame is assigned. They are stupid. They are wrong. Teachers and cops are there to sort it out, with a trail of paperwork to illustrate the stupidity, the faults, the evidence and incidents of these things. We have entire systems in place to help decide who is what. Sometimes the systems don't work. Families spend their weekend afternoons at animal shelters, even when they're not looking for a pet. They come to see the unwanted and unloved, the cats and dogs who don't understand why they are these things. They are petted and combed, walked and fed, cooed over and kissed. Then they go back in their cages, and sometimes tears are shed. Fuzzy faces peering through bars can be unbearable for many. Change the face to a human one, and the reaction changes. The reason why is because people should know better. But our logic is skewed in this respect. A dog that bites is a dead dog. First day at the shelter, and I already saw one put to sleep, which in itself is a misleading phrase. Sleep implies that you have the option of waking up. Once their bodies pass unconsciousness to something deeper where systems start to fail, they revolt a little bit, put up a fight on a molecular level. They kick, they cry, they don't want to go. And this happens because their jaws closed over a human hand, ever so briefly, maybe even just the once. But people, they get chances. They get the benefit of the doubt, even though they have the higher logic functioning, and they knew when they did it. They knew it was a bad thing. The shelter is running a neuter and spay clinic next month. One of my jobs this morning is to get the mail, fighting the urge to throw a rock at a speeding car when the driver wolf whistles at me. The mailbox is full of applications for the clinic, most of them for dogs, but a handful of cats as well. Rhonda, the lady who runs the shelter, has me sort them out, dogs and cats, male and female. Rhonda snorts when she sees all the male dogs on the roster. "People don't learn," she says. "What do you mean?" I ask. "Everyone thinks if you fix a male dog, it will lower his aggression, but most of the biters are female. It's basic instinct to protect their own womb. You see it in all animals. The female of the species is more deadly than the male." "Except humans," the other girl volunteering says. The phone rings. I answer, saying, "Tri-County Animal Shelter, this is Alex," instead of saying to the girl, "You wouldn't be in a position to know," which is what had been on the tip of my tongue. Rhonda gets a call about a stray out on the county line, so she takes the pound truck and tells us to hold down the fort. There's not much to hold down at this particular fort for the moment. The mornings are filled with volunteer dog walkers and wives who like to pet cats but aren't allowed to have one at home. All of those people have slowly seeped out. The other girl and I are waiting out the last 15 minutes, me at the desk, pretending to sort through spay and neuter applications so that I don't have to make conversation, her on her hands and knees, poking her fingers through the cage our lone bunny resides in, which we dragged out to the waiting room, hoping that someone would cave and take her home. The front door swings open, slamming against the wall hard enough to knock down 3 lost cat posters and an informational pamphlet about Lyme disease. A woman with a red face and eyebrows that are permanently frowned into a meeting position above her nose comes in, talking before she even looks at me. "Someone just tossed a bag of puppies out down on 9, she says. "County Road 9? I ask for clarification, mostly because I know it will annoy her and because I don't like how she's talking to me. Or rather, not talking to me, just shouting words in my direction, already half turned toward the door to leave. "Yes, County Road 9, she snaps. "What'd you think I meant?" The other girl pulls her fingers out of the bunny cage and stands up but doesn't approach us. She hovers in the background, like if I need support, she might actually say something, but I shouldn't count on it. This annoys me as well, so now I'm happy with no one in the room. "Where out on 9? I ask, pulling out a slip of paper to write it down. "Right before the curve," the lady says. "He slowed down a bit and chucked the bag out the window." "How do you know it was puppies?" I ask. "Excuse me?" she says, the brows finally separating a little as they fly upward. "How do you know the bag has puppies in it?" I had to swerve to miss it, she says, her voice losing a bit of its edge. I could see it in the way that it rolled, you know, like there was something inside trying to get out. Could have been kittens, I say. What does it matter? The lady half yells at me. I came here to the shelter to tell you there's a bag of kittens or puppies or whatever lying in the ditch on 9, and you're not doing anything about it. Why didn't you stop? I ask, feeling my internal gear switch from argumentative to combative smoothly, a well-oiled machine. What? She's fuming now, her breath coming in shallow gasps that aren't giving her brain enough oxygen. You swerved to miss the bag. You care enough to report it, so why didn't you stop and do something yourself? My kids are in the minivan, she says. I didn't want them to see anything they shouldn't. Look, I'm doing everything I can. I feel sorry for those puppies. I'm sure they appreciate your pity, I say. She's done playing nice. I see her own gears switching and know that I've pushed too far, called out a sanctimonious would-be do-gooder who isn't going to fold under my logic. Who is your supervisor? She asks, glancing around the room as if suddenly realizing she's the only adult here. God, I say.
Chapter 5. PK. God? I close the passenger door of Alex's car, and she kind of half-smiles as she starts it. The shelter is locked up, the sign flipped to closed, a heavy cloud of dust marring the air from the lady in the minivan who tore down the driveway like we'd loosed a biter on her. Alex left a message on Rhonda's phone telling her we were checking into a tossed bag that is moving out on 9, not specifying puppies or kittens. Technically it's true, she says, in an answer to my question. So you believe in God? I want to kick myself as soon as I ask it, because first of all, it's not the best icebreaker in the world, and secondly, I just firmly filled in all the cracks of the preacher's kid mold I'm trying to crawl out of. But Alex shoots back with a question I'm not expecting. Do you? I don't think anyone has ever asked me that before. It's assumed, like the fact that I don't own any naughty underwear or I'm tattoo-free. Yeah, I say, and that's actually the truth. I don't like being a PK, but I'm not a liar either. Why? I feel my imaginary ruff going up, like a dog trying to make itself look bigger. I don't know Alex. I don't know if I like her, and I don't feel like defending something as big as my belief in God during our first conversation. I'm about to say something along those lines to her, even though it'll be the pared-down version of fuck off, but I bite my tongue. All the shitty things I could possibly say back up in my brain, because it sounded like an honest question, not a single-syllable word laced with derision, which is what I'm used to. And I guess if I'm going to be working with Alex at the shelter, we have to speak to each other at some point. Might as well cut the shit. I take a second to put together a real answer, not some blow-off recitation of Jesus loves me where I tell her it's because the Bible tells me so. I know I've got something to say, but I want to get the words right, so I look out the window as Alex drives toward 9. We hit the one light in town on a green and head north, going past 3 bars and 2 pizza places before we get to the dead zone, a couple of paved streets with real signs, 5th and 6th, but nothing on them except dead-end drives. The town planners got a little overexcited in the 90s about what they thought the new calculator plant could bring to the community. Ended up, all it had to offer was a broken lease and a big empty building 2 years in. Oh, and like a lifetime supply of free calculators for the school. But then someone programmed them all to spell boobs when they powered on. 58008, upside down. And they got tossed into a school auction. In a terrible twist of fate, a church the next town over bought them for their school supply drive, and apparently a bunch of fifth graders got more than they bargained for the first day of math class. But none of that musing is getting me any closer to giving Alex an answer about why I believe in God, and she's kind of giving me the side eye while she drives. I guess it's because sometimes when I'm really upset, If I quiet down and let myself be still, I can feel something. Tears well up in my eyes even as I say it, because Lord knows I've been really upset lately, and that feeling of comfort surrounding me for no reason I can put a finger on. Well, yeah, it makes a girl cry. Even one who's trying to shed the PK stigma. But in the end, it's still a shit answer. So I'm surprised when Alex nods like she totally gets it. You feel it too? I ask. She shrugs. No, not like that. But things have a way of falling into place for me when I need them to. Cool, I say, and our big soul-bearing is over. Alex turns onto Nine and we spot the bag at the same time. It's an industrial-strength black garbage bag, visible heat waves rolling off it. Alex pulls over and puts her hazards on, although why she bothers, I don't know. We're surrounded by cornfields waiting for harvest, and haven't seen another vehicle since we passed the last bar in town. We both get out of the car. I know before we get to it that there's no hope. The bag's not moving, which is part of it. But there's also the reek of urine in the air and the slight metal tang of fresh blood. I don't even know if I want to see inside, but Alex doesn't hesitate. She opens it without flinching, both smells amped by about 1,000 when she does. I look away. I hear the rustle of the bag while Alex checks to make sure they're actually dead, and then the zip sound of her lacing the drawstrings up tight and double knotting them. 3 puppies, she says. 2 broken necks and an asphyxiation. I look up and down the road. The only sound, the dry corn stalks rustling against one another, and the persistent, regular ticking of Alex's hazard lights. No chance anybody saw him out here, I say. No, Alex says, taking the bag to her trunk and laying it in gently. She snaps the lid shut. But at least that lady felt sorry for them. We head back to the shelter, Alex in silence, me fuming. I've got my mouth clamped shut tight, all my breath coming in and out of my nose in short little bursts. All I can think about is that truck flying down the road, the hands that would have put their sleek little bodies in the bag before tossing it out like so much garbage. A puppy feels like life and love. Their entire bodies are soft. Fur, skin, the pads of their feet new and delicate. They radiate warmth in the way science can explain, but it goes further than that. The heat of affection pours out of their eyes and makes their little butts wiggle like crazy as soon as they see a person. They don't even care who. Their love encapsulated. And someone touched that, put it in a bag, and killed it. We come to a 4-way stop in the middle of nowhere, corn stubble on one side of us, a collapsing barn on the other. It's one of those places that have stop signs on all the corners for no apparent reason, because never in the history of a county have there been 4 cars here at the same time. But there is another right now, an elderly lady in her Buick. She waves at us to go ahead, and Alex waves back, her fingers a casual upflick on top of the steering wheel. My breath is catching in my chest, my mind still thinking of the puppies wriggling together, trying to draw comfort from one another in the overheated trash bag, the little whining noises they would have made to signal to the guy driving that they were scared, their mystification that he didn't care, and the sound it would have made when the bag hit the road. For 1 second, I wonder what I would have done if there had been a truck sitting at the intersection, and I let myself follow the thought. I imagine a rusted-out truck, a guy wearing a t-shirt with ripped-out sleeves. I think about how he'd rolled down his window, a casual question on his face until I open the door, drag him out and kick him in the gut over and over and over until he's making the same noise as those puppies probably were. It's a fantasy, and I know it. I'm a tiny thing, 5'4", and on the days I have to bring more than 2 textbooks home, I struggle lifting my backpack. I'm not big. I'm not strong. I'm not intimidating. I will never kick the shit out of anyone, and even if I had the chance, I wouldn't do it. But it kind of feels good to think about it.
Chapter 6, Jack. I'm the guy who other people want to be. I see it in their looks when I sink a three-pointer, hear it in the collective roar from the stands when I score the game-winning touchdown and do a series of backflips, and fuck the ref for throwing an excessive celebration penalty flag anyway. I can do those things and look good before, during, and after, knowing the whole time that I'll have at least one tit shot texted to me that night. And then on Monday, I can go to any one of my classes and deliver a speech, nail an exam, or speak in a foreign language the entire time without blinking, because I am the whole package. I get girls, I get trophies, and I most definitely am going to get to be valedictorian. Except, I'm not. Alex Kraft is. I'm sitting next to her in the guidance counselor's office with my mouth hanging open just enough that I've probably disqualified myself from salutatorian as well. I don't understand, I say for the third time. I've got a 4.0. So does Alex, the guidance counselor says. And she's taken more weighted classes than you have. But I want... I close my mouth then, aware it's more than a want, it's a need. If I can't get a scholarship, I won't be going to college. I'll be another senior who says they're taking a year off first and then ends up trying to pay for my kid's college from behind a burger grill, wondering what the fuck happened. And then my kid'll do the same thing, and when I retire, I can cede my spot in the drive-thru to my grandkid. I can keep my body in shape anywhere, but my brain is going to rot in this shitty little town because I'm too poor to get out of here without a free ride. I'm so focused on me, I'm not sure I've heard her right when Alex says, "You should just give it to him." Alex, who could write a book about things that aren't fair. That guy in the woods had it right 3 years ago. I'm a douchebag. Miss Reynolds' eyebrows come together. Class rank is not given, Alex, it's earned. It's nonsensical for me to have it. I'm not going to college. Now the guidance counselor's mouth tightens as she says, "We've talked about this, and..." "Why wouldn't you go to college?" I interrupt Miss Reynolds, turning to look, really look, at Alex. I don't think I've ever been this close to her, and when she turns her head, I see how green her eyes are. She shrugs. "I can't conceive of myself outside this place." "Okay," I say, glancing at the guidance counselor. She smiles at me encouragingly, but her eyebrows are still stuck together in concern. "It's very simple," Alex says patiently, dividing her words between the two of us. "We've both earned it. He wants it. Give it to him." The way she says this makes it seem so easy that I know I'm wearing a, "yeah, see," look on my face. But the guidance counselor sighs and shakes her head. "I can't just arbitrarily decide who is the valedictorian." "You're misinterpreting where arbitrary fits in this conversation," Alex says. Miss Reynolds closes her eyes and pinches the bridge of her nose. I get the feeling she's had many, many conversations with Alex that end this way. When she looks up, she's got her professional face back on. "A lot of things can change before the end of the year," she says. "And Jack, you need to remember that being salutatorian is nothing to sneeze at." Which to me sounds like Alex is very unlikely to make any mistakes, so you need to start adjusting to the new reality. Alex and I walk out of the office together, and I find myself in an awkward situation that only people from small towns can appreciate. I know Alex Kraft. I know her in the sense that I could pick her out of my class photos from kindergarten on. I know her because people don't leave this place, and our parents know each other. Hell, I'm pretty sure my mom dated her dad. I know her because everyone knows everybody here, and Alex especially, because her sister is the only reason a news crew has been in this town, ever. I know Alex Kraft, and I have nothing to say to her, but I want to find some words that will make her look at me again, because I liked the way her green eyes stood out among all those freckles. And the part of me that goes to AP English digs that she's smart, while the part of me that slaughters freshmen with dodgeballs is kind of turned on by the idea that I'm competing against her for something. And she's walking away from me. I know how to do this. I know the things to say to people that will keep them at arm's length while reinforcing how cool I am. I know how to speed up or slow down to give them the idea that you're really not into talking to them, and the distance between the two of you grows, even though you're the only ones in the hallway. I know how to make a joke about taking a shit and duck into the bathroom for a few minutes until they're gone. Instead, I take a few extra inches in my stride until I'm keeping pace with Alex. I see her eyes flick in my direction for a nanosecond when she picks me up in her peripheral, but she doesn't slow down. "Crazy, huh?" I say.
"Excuse me?"
"The valedictorian thing. Crazy." She stops at her locker, gaze going to the hallway clock instead of me. I don't know that it's crazy so much as an indication that we're both intelligent people. "But you're more intelligent." Alex spins her combination lock. "Not necessarily. I've never been quite clear how such a thing is determined. They take your GPA and..."
"I know how the school does it," she says, snapping her locker open. "I mean in general."
"Oh," I say, because I can't really think of anything else. The bell rings. The sound slices through the hall, scattering all the words I'm trying so hard to accumulate between us. She jumps as if she wasn't expecting it, her hands curling into fists. "Are you okay?" I ask.
"No,"
she says immediately, the unexpectedness of the question prompting an honest answer. "Can I help? Have your number? Touch your arm? Get you to look at me again? All of these things are utterly lost as my name comes rolling down the hallway in Park's drawl. "Jack!" he's calling for me, more than a little obnoxious as he turns the corner to find me at Alex's locker. The halls are filling up, and there's no reason for him to think that I've actually been talking to her, except she's finally looking at me again, waiting for me to finish whatever this sentence is going to turn into. And I can't come up with a single goddamn word. My mouth is hanging open, and it's like she's the hook, and I'm a fish, and I can't do anything but flop around when Park pushes his body against mine so that we're touching from toes to forehead. And all I can think is, Jesus, really? Right now? This is the moment he chooses to pull out a joke from seventh grade? "Jack, baby," he says, "I missed you so much." He clenches my head in his hands and covers my mouth with his thumbs and fake kisses me so hard, I swear I'll have bruising tomorrow. "And you, girl," he says to Alex after pulling away from me, "I could just eat you up." He's going for her with a big dumb grin on his face, absolutely certain that she will have no problem with him smashing his fingers into her lips and his face up to hers. Her expression doesn't change. That slightly confused look that had been directed at me as I struggled with words now turns to Park as the fist that never unclenched finds a target. She drops her shoulder to gain some momentum as she takes a jab at his crotch, one bony knuckle protruding on purpose for maximum effect as if she wants to pop his testicles like water balloons. And he goes down like a box of rocks.
Chapter 7. PK. We are having a funeral for Park's balls. That's how it seems, anyway. After Alex brought him to his knees in the hallway and walked away like she'd done nothing more than litter, Park curled up into the fetal position. He pulled the hood of his sweatshirt up over his head so that nobody could see his face while he recovered his masculinity, and everyone gave him a wide berth. The hallway was totally silent except for the occasional "what happened," followed by an explanation, followed by the kind of respectful silence we reserve for male groin injuries. Jack tried to talk to him, but got only grunts in response, and everyone decided to leave him there and went to class. Mr. Franklin walked past a few minutes ago, and I imagine he'll say a lot of understanding things that end in "buddy" for a while until he can coax Park up off the floor. Miss Hendricks wasn't quite sure what to do because she isn't equipped to offer support to Park, and not forceful enough to make us stop talking about it. So instead of discussing Crime and Punishment, which Alex is calmly sitting in her seat reading, we're talking about the fact that Park was dick-punched. The guys are laughing their asses off. They keep reenacting it and attempting to fist-bump Alex, but she couldn't be less interested. The girls are split into two camps. the ones who have on very straight faces and keep saying that Park could be seriously injured, and those who find it genuinely amusing every time one of the boys involved in the instant replay pretends to reinflate their balls by blowing on their thumbs. I'm part of this last group. Branley, who everyone knows is a friend to all penises, isn't making much of an effort to control her volume, and her natural soprano is grating on my nerves. "What if he can't have kids now?" she asks, a perfect little pout following up her intense concern for Park's man parts. "That's just crazy!" More emphasis than necessary is put on this last word, and she glances at Alex as she says it, who turns a page of Dostoevsky. A little burn of resentment starts down in my belly, and I try to quash it fast. I don't know if it's because Alex and I have established a kind of companionable silence after incinerating 3 dead puppies, or if it has more to do with the fact that Branley now traipses around holding Adam's hand, but I really want to shut her up. Seeing the two of them together hasn't been easy. I finally answered a call from Dickface. He's been renamed in my phone, all heart emoticons removed, about a week ago. I guess it was our official breakup, even though he'd been sharing one chair with Branley at lunch ever since Sarah sent me that screen cap. "Babe," he'd explained, unable to drop the endearment even as he dumped me. "It's Branley Jacobs. I have a shot at Branley Jacobs. I can't pass that up." I guess he expected some sort of congratulations from me as he climbed the social ladder, stepping on the skull of the preacher's kid so that he could jam his face up the skirt of the blonde cheerleader. And he seems pretty happy, so whatever, fuck him. "Fuck her," Sarah says, as she flops into the chair next to mine. "Right?" I agree, but can't stop my eyes from going back to Branley as she keeps using words like vicious and dangerous. Branley is kind of perfect. One of those girls who wears matte foundation and always looks like a porcelain doll. Except, I think if you spread a doll's leg as far as hers go, they would break. I can say this with some accuracy because of the pic she sent my boyfriend. Ex-boyfriend. I concentrate on that. Ex-boyfriend, ex-boyfriend, ex-boyfriend. And flip open my own copy of Crime and Punishment as I try to distract myself from a visual I accidentally created. A picture of Branley's perfectly molded, heart-shaped face breaking into shards under my fist. I clench my fists and my teeth, warping a classic paperback and shredding my own enamel at the same time. Miss Hendricks finally gets everyone in their seats, and Branley passes my desk, leaving the scent of strawberry vanilla shampoo in her wake. She tosses her phone into her open backpack on the floor, and I can't help but glance at it. I expected to see a selfie background, something coyly posed and angled for maximum cheekbone effect, probably shot from above to make sure the cleavage gets its due. Instead, it's her little sister, holding a vanilla ice cream cone, while a clearly well-trained St. Bernard stares longingly, dual slobber chains caught in mid-wobble. "Nice. I want to punch a St. Bernard owner, the most patient people on earth." "Good job being the preacher's kid, PK. Good fucking job."
Chapter 8. Alex. We use objects to navigate spaces, making a map in our heads as neurons fire, pathways so well worn we don't even know we reference them as we move from one location to the next. The same pattern every day. There are things in place to help us, signs in certain colors and shapes, arrows pointing, symbols indicating. Making your own framework is more entertaining, more personal, less constricting. The blue house she would have seen last. The tree that has bloomed 3 times since then. The dirt road that used to be gravel. The gravel road that is now paved. The paved road that is disintegrating back into gravel. Here in this building, I have the dent in the locker where I broke my wrist after hearing a rape joke, dropped as casually as pocket lint. A ceiling tile still knocked askew 2 years after I took a vicious kick at thin air and my shoe flew off. No one has noticed it. the residually sticky spot on the wall outside the science classrooms where the anatomy classes hang their posters with double-sided tape every year, the obligatory genitalia comically large. Nothing hangs there now but a thread of my own hair, torn out. No one sees me do these things. Until today. Now there is a new place. A place where a boy came at my face with his hands, his mouth open, tongue out. A place where he fell, pale-faced. A place where his tears pooled afterward. It is a place where I did not mean to, but it happened. I use my markers as I go from place to place, seeing evidence of my small rebellions, spots where my wrath was allowed to vent and has impacted the world around me, no longer safely encapsulated inside. My life is made of these tiny maps. My path's always steady as I move inside a constricted area, the only one I should ever be allowed to know. My violence is everywhere here. And I like it.
Chapter 9. PK. If I were to uncoil my trumpet, I'd have 4.5 feet of brass pipe. This fact was on repeat in my head at last night's football game, because I was seriously considering dismantling my instrument so that I could wrap it around Branley's swan-white neck and strangle her. I also considered just sticking all 4 feet into the ground right when her squad threw her up in the air so that when she came down, she'd be impaled on it. I played out both scenarios in my head, picturing the cheerleaders screeching as I choked their poster child, the other bandies trying to stop me. Maybe one of the trombone players would hook me with her slide. I imagined the stunned silence that would emanate from the bleachers after the homecoming queen had a trumpet bell explode from her chest when she came down from a toss, her perfect smile slipping into confusion, Adam running from the sidelines, his football spikes clicking against the track. He'd hold her while she died, and maybe one of the other trumpet players would do a riff on Taps. And then I spotted her little sister in the stands. 2 blonde pigtails poking from either side of her head, a popcorn kernel stuck on her chin as she cheered along with Branley, who she probably thinks is perfect. I reminded myself there's a St. Bernard with big, woeful eyes who loves Branley. So, of course, I did none of those things. Instead, I wallowed in my rage and missed a quarter turn on the 30-yard line that threw off the entire trumpet section during the halftime show. So, that's karma for you. Anger makes you tired, but guilt keeps you from falling asleep. So I hit my alarm twice this morning, even though it's Saturday and my SYE is as good as a class and I need to get my ass out of bed. I'm still the first one at the shelter, and there's a dump. It's a mutt, part retriever, maybe, part shepherd, maybe. Definitely all pain and anger. Rhonda told me this has been happening more lately with the shitty economy. People can't afford their pets, but they can't pay the surrender fee either. So they tie their dog to the fence at night and drive away. Once someone didn't even cough up the money for a chain, instead just chucking the poor dog in the trash. Rhonda found that one. She had to climb into the empty dumpster while Alex and I leaned over the side, standing on chairs, Rhonda's arms wobbling as she tried to get the terrified dog to us, and we tried to get him over the edge without losing our balance. But today is something new. Someone apparently tossed this dog over the fence. And I'm guessing he didn't land right because he's holding one paw up in the air and showing teeth at me as I twirl the combination lock on the gate. His fur has a fine coating of early November frost, which can't feel good. "It's okay," I say quietly. "I'm here now." He doesn't seem convinced that everything is okay. And when I get a closer look at him, I understand why. Someone really did not give a shit about this dog. One of his eyes is crusted completely shut, and both his ears are sprouting growths. "Not a lot of love, huh, buddy?" I say, and he lunges at me through the fence, teeth clicking against the wire. The wave of stench that follows him makes me back off more than the snarl. I'm sitting on the concrete step with my hand over my nose when Alex pulls up. "What?" she asks as she gets out, using one word to encompass me, the dog, and the locked door. "Rhonda's not here yet," I say through the sleeve of my sweatshirt. "Somebody dumped this guy. I think they threw him over the fence. He's got a broken leg and smells something awful." Alex walks toward the fence, and he goes for her. "You might want to leave him alone," I say, "unless you think you can punch him in the dick through the fence." The words pop out before I realize it, but Alex doesn't seem to care. She digs into her pockets and pulls out a set of keys. "Rhonda gave me these last week," she explains. "She said we're familiar enough with the morning routine to handle it alone. She'll come at open hours." "Fair enough," I say, accepting the duplicate that Alex hands me. We walk into the front office. My heart dips a little every time. There's a single desk with a phone, a computer someone gave us when they upgraded, and a line of metal folding chairs the church donated a few years ago. That's the sum of our only weapons in the battle to help unwanted animals across three counties find homes. And the phone is a rotary phone. Sometimes I'm really glad that the door separating the office and the kennels is solid and heavy as hell. I don't want them to see how hopeless it all is. Alex flips the lock behind her, and we glance at each other in the oddly private space of a public area before the lights are turned on. "I would never punch a dog in the dick," she says. I bust out laughing. She's so intense, her mouth in the firmest, flattest line I've ever seen, serious as my dad on Easter morning. I've never heard her say anything normal. 2 months of working with Alex Kraft, and I've learned that she doesn't say, "huh." She says, "I'm sorry, could you repeat that?" Alex says, "Were you able to scoop the litter pans this morning?" Not, "Did you get the cat shit?" So when she says I would never punch a dog in the dick with the same gravity as a newscaster on 9/11, I laugh hysterically. And I think maybe, just maybe, there's the slightest upturn of a smile on the corner of her lips as she turns the lights on. "What do you think about the dump?" "I suppose we should wait for Rhonda," she says. "Unless you think we can get him to come in through the outside run and into one of the caged kennels." "We can try. He might bite, though." She shakes her head. "He's scared, not mean. I'll stay inside and open the run gate. You see if you can steer him in the right direction from outside." "Deal." I head outside, grabbing a pair of gloves from the staff shelf as I do. They're heavy, but I know if he wanted to, that dog could have it off my hands, skin included. And once he bites me, scared or mean, he's dead. He backs into a corner when I go to the gate, front leg dragging. There's a continuous low growl as I walk in, swinging it shut behind me. "Hey, buddy," I say quietly, going down in a crouch so that he doesn't think I'm trying to intimidate him. "We're gonna get you inside, okay? It'll be warmer, and there'll be food, and..." I'm trying to think of something else enticing when a voice pipes up behind me. "And surgery, by the looks of it," Rhonda says. I wasn't going to tell him that part. Just then, Alex opens the run from inside and he turns toward it, teeth on display. Alex backs out of his sight and the warmth emanating from the building is enough to coax him to follow. "You shouldn't be in there." Rhonda pulls the lock off and opens the gate. He's mad and hurt and feels cornered. Never know what a threatened animal will do. "Sorry," I say as I slip outside. "We just thought we should try to get him in if we could." "Nice idea. But he hurts either of you girls, he gets put down, and I doubt the school sends me any more volunteers." I follow her into the office, stripping off the gloves. We're heading back to the kennels when the barking starts. First thing in the morning is always the worst, which is why I prefer the cat room. Alex doesn't seem to mind the clamor of a dozen dogs all waking up hungry, sick of being caged and desperate for attention. The cats just stretch languidly, take jaw-cracking yawns, and then look at you like, "Oh, have you come to feed me? Splendid." If the dogs like Alex, then they love Rhonda. I swear they know the second she walks in the door. They don't have to see her or even hear her. They just get so spontaneously happy, some of them literally lose their shit. Alex has convinced the dump to follow her from the outside run to a kennel. She's making all the right noises to reassure him, but the cinder block walls aren't overly inviting even on a good day, and that dog is not having a good day. Alex is down in a crouch with her hip holding the kennel door open while the other dogs explode at the sight of Rhonda. The dump, who had taken his freakout from an 8 down to about a 2, snarls and shoots forward into the kennel. Alex swings the cage door shut, and it all would have been very nicely handled except for the fact that she's in there with him. "Get out of there," Rhonda says. Alex shakes her head and slides down to the concrete floor, her jeans soaking up the bleach water she'd sprayed around earlier. "Don't want to startle him," Alex says tightly. And while she has a point, the dog's ruff is up as high as he can get it, his teeth out for more than show, and he's climbed onto the cot so that he's got some height on her. I hear something more in Alex's voice. Even though we've exchanged only a handful of words, I know her tone. And I'm pretty sure that dog bit her when he ran past, and she's trying to hide it. "You probably shouldn't make any sudden movements," I say. "Maybe just let him get calmed down and we'll get you out of there." Alex looks at me and nods, while Rhonda eyes the dog warily. He's still growling, but the snarl is out of his tone. "All right," she says, "but..." The doorbell from the front office chimes, sending everybody into a fresh peal of barking. "Christ," Rhonda mutters, backing away from the kennel door. "Stay here in case he gets it in his head to rip hers off." I nod, even though I'm unsure what to do if Alex is decapitated, and drop down to my knees to talk to her through the kennel door. "He get you?" "Right in my butt," she says, and I start giggling again, even though it's not funny. "How bad?" I ask. "I'm bleeding." Alex lifts her rear off the floor for a second, and we share an awkward moment of me investigating her ass through a wire fence. "Your jeans are ripped, but you're not bleeding too bad. If Rhonda finds out..." "I know." We look at each other through the wire for a second as the dog relaxes onto its back legs, a whimper escaping as its dangling paw bumps the side of the cot. "I've got my yoga bag in the car," I say. "I'll bring it in. Tell Rhonda your clothes are all wet. You can clean yourself up in the bathroom." Alex gives me a quick once-over, and I know what she's thinking. Her legs are probably as long as my whole body. "Wear high waters or have a wet ass all day. Your choice," I say. Alex considers this for a second. "I'll wear your clothes. But first, would you do me a favor?" "Sure." "Sneak me a tranquilizer for him. If he's unreasonable when the vets get here, it won't go well." It wouldn't be hard. The key to the meds hangs on the wall right next to the cabinet, a silent testimony to how much Rhonda trusts her volunteers. Hard? No. Totally legal? I'm not clear on that. But the exhausted sound that escapes the dump as he settles onto his cot, followed by the pathetic scraping of his tongue over his paw in an attempt to get to a hurt he can't understand, undoes me. "Be right back," I say. It's quick and easy. I sneak the pill to Alex, wrapped in a slice of ham I pilfered out of my own lunch. When I hand it to her through the wire, our fingers touch briefly, slippery with grease, and I think, this is how you become friends with Alex Kraft. "Dogs are really good at taking the treat and spitting out the pill," I say, watching through the fence as the dump chows down. "Make sure he gets the whole thing." "She," Alex says. "What?" "It's a girl," she says, reaching a tentative hand out to the dump, who growls again, low and threatening. "Either way, it has teeth," I say. "Watch it." "It's okay, girl," Alex says, her voice entirely different than when she speaks to me or Rhonda. It's melodious and gentle, with an undercurrent of emotion I wouldn't have dreamed her capable of. "I won't hurt you," she says, and the dog hesitantly sniffs the ham. It disappears in a few seconds, hunger outweighing caution. The dump bows her head, watching Alex's hand come nearer until it rests on her crown and they both relax, the tension slipping out of the cage, until the only thing I can hear is them breathing in unison.
Chapter 10, Jack. It has been 2 weeks since I talked to Alex. 2 weeks since she dropped my best friend to the ground at my feet. 2 weeks that I've wished every girl